Welcome to another KABU Public Affairs special focus on the crisis in Gaza. I'm William Seaman, and co-hosting today's special program, it's my great pleasure to once again be sharing the studio with Hala Gores. Hala, good to see you again.
Good morning, Will. Good morning to our listeners.
I'd like our listeners to know that a little later in the program, we are going to be taking calls. So if you have a question for one of our guests or for Hala and myself, please consider calling KABU at 503-231-8187, and of course we'll be giving that number again. We're very fortunate to have with us by telephone two very special guests this morning. In about 30 minutes, we'll be speaking with Israeli historian Ilan Pappe. But first, Hala is going to introduce our first guest for this morning.
Thank you, Will. Before I introduce our first guest, I would like to tell our listeners they can provide us feedback by emailing us at pdx@riseup.net.
Actually, that's pdxjustice@riseup.net. We have a little typo in our notes.
Sorry about that. Joining us from Ramallah in the West Bank is Deanna Buttu. Ms. Buttu is a Palestinian-Canadian lawyer born to Palestinian parents. She received a law degree from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, and a PhD from Stanford University. Ms. Buttu is a legal advisor and spokesperson with the Palestine Liberation Organization. She advises on peace negotiations with Israel and on refugee issues. In 2000, she left North America to move to Palestine in order to assist with the then peace negotiations between the Palestinians and Israel as one of the PLO's legal advisors. With the outbreak of the second Palestinian uprising, the Intifada, against Israel's occupation, and the breakdown of negotiations, Deanna decided to remain in Palestine. She gained prominence during Israel's invasion of the West Bank, serving as spokesperson for the PLO. Ms. Buttu assisted in the litigation against Israel's apartheid wall at The Hague in 2004, a resounding victory for the Palestinians and an indictment of Israel's wall. In 2005, she was appointed President Abbas's communications director. She has since left her official post. She now resides in Palestine, where she's writing a book on the Israeli occupation. Prior to moving to Palestine in 2000, Ms. Buttu also served as legal counsel to the Canadian Department of Justice. Good morning, Ms. Buttu.
Good morning.
And it's actually evening your time, isn't it?
It is. It's evening my time. It's it's about 6 o'clock in the evening my time.
Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Can you please give our listeners some idea of the size of the Gaza Strip and how densely populated it is?
The Gaza Strip, which is a place that I actually lived for a period of about a year, is the most densely populated place on Earth. It's about 26 miles long and 12 miles wide at its widest point, with about 1.3 million people living in the Gaza Strip, many of whom are refugees who have been denied the ability to return to their homes in what is now Israel because of the fact that they are not, because of the fact that they're not Jewish, they're Christians and Muslims, and so they live in refugee camps, unable to return to their homes inside Israel. Apart from being the most densely populated place on Earth, the Gaza Strip is an area that that is completely controlled on all sides, whether it's the airspace that's controlled by Israel, the sea coast is controlled by Israel, or even the borders. The border between Israel and the Gaza Strip is controlled by Israel, or the border crossing between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. So every single aspect of the Gaza Strip itself is actually controlled by Israel. So it's a tiny strip of land, very densely populated, but despite the dense population, the Palestinians remain under Israeli military control, unable to move or to do anything without getting Israeli permission.
But Deanna, many in Israel and the West talk about the disengagement that Israel basically stopped occupying the Gaza Strip. Is that accurate?
The Israelis, there were two things that were happening from 1967 up until the year 2005 in the Gaza Strip. And there are two processes that I think people often confuse. The first was there was a colonization process. And what that meant was that the Israeli government was actually taking Palestinian land in the Gaza Strip and using it to build settlements, colonies, for Israelis only. These colonies are about, there were roughly 21 of them at the time. They had an estimated 8,000 Israelis. But these 8,000 Israelis living in the Gaza Strip at the time had more rights than the remaining 1.3 million Palestinians who were residing there. They had better water consumption. They were allowed to travel wherever they wanted to. They didn't need Israeli permission for anything. And on top of that, the 8,000 Israelis controlled approximately 30% of the land. Now, that colonization process came to an end last year in 2005 when the Israeli government dismantled the settlements, the colonies in the Gaza Strip, and evacuated the settlers. There was another process, however, that was taking place at that same time between 1967, and that continues till today, and that is the occupations, the military control over the Gaza Strip. So, but that, unfortunately, that aspect of Israel's activity has not come to an end. And what I mean by that is that everything from controlling the movement of people to the movement of goods to whether people are allowed to work inside Israel or not work inside Israel, almost every single aspect of Palestinian life is actually controlled by Israel and remains under Israeli control. So while last year the colonization of the Gaza Strip came to a close, the actual occupation of it and control over it still continues to this day. So I think that's why there's a great deal of confusion.
Thank you for clarifying that. Can you tell us about the recent events starting in May, June of this year, please?
So about the recent events?
Starting with, I think in the West they talk about all of this starting with the abduction of Gilad Shalit, but things had started earlier than that in terms of the Israeli attack on Gaza and Gazans.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. What we now are reading about in Gaza, and I think not so many of us are actually seeing anything about it, is something that has been continuing for a long period of time. This didn't just start with the capture of an Israeli soldier, but has actually gone on for almost 39 years, but most specifically over the course of the past year. And what has happened over the course of the past year is that after the Israelis evacuated the settlements of the Gaza Strip, they basically locked down the Gaza Strip and threw away the key and tightened the screws on the Gaza Strip. So everything from military raids over the space of Gaza and bombing of Palestinian homes, continued assassinations of Palestinians, using the sea waters to actually attack Palestinians who were sitting on the beach, and we saw very dramatically the attack and killing of one young girl's family as she was sitting there on the beach herself. All of these activities have been things that have continued ever since last year, but then I think people seem to forget and instead are now focusing on the actual capture of the Israeli soldier and saying that that is what has precipitated these events, but when in fact it has not. This is something that has been continuing now for years and years and years, but most specifically over the course of the past year. Unfortunately, there hasn't been a lot of media coverage of the issue.
Well, that brings me to another issue on the media coverage. Why is it that in the West we hear very little about what is happening in Gaza and the West Bank?
There's a few reasons, actually. It's a really good question, and there's a few reasons that we don't hear so much about what's happening in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank as compared to when something happens inside Israel. The first reason is that the Gaza Strip and West Bank are areas that are very, very, very difficult to get to and very difficult to move around in. So, for example, to get to the Gaza Strip, you actually need Israeli permission to enter into the Gaza Strip. Even as a Canadian, need Israeli permission to go into the Gaza Strip, and that permission is granted by the Israeli army. If they do not want me to go in, which has been the case now for several months, then I cannot go in. Similarly, when it comes to media coverage, actually getting into the Gaza Strip in a lot of cases is very difficult. Journalists are quite hesitant to go down there. It takes a lot to go down there. And then on your way out, you're always subject to incredible security searches as one is leaving the Gaza Strip. Everything from using an entire X-ray machine to scan, to do a full body scan, to actually denying certain goods the ability to leave the Gaza Strip. So it becomes a very arduous process for people to get in and out of the Gaza Strip. In the West Bank, the situation is slightly different. While you don't need a permit to enter into the West Bank, the West Bank is riddled with checkpoints, such that to get into any Palestinian city, you have to cross a number of checkpoints to get into that city. So for journalists who are on a tight deadline, they can't really take the predictability, the unpredictability of the checkpoints, and so a lot of times they simply just don't come to the places in the West Bank. Another major reason is also a structural reason, which is that of of censorship. While the Israeli government claims that it doesn't officially censor the articles of journalists, it does a sort of thing of trying to, for example, deny entry into certain journalists if they don't like the coverage, to also not renewing the visas of certain journalists if they don't like the coverage. For example, the BBC or BBC reporter who for many, many years the Israeli government was saying that they did not want her to return because they didn't like her coverage, and in the end at one point denied entry into the BBC bureau chief as a means of sending a message to the BBC that they were not happy with the BBC's coverage. So that's yet another reason. But beyond that, I think that there's an even bigger reason that the issue of what's going on in the West Bank and Gaza is not covered. And I think that it's just become very commonplace on the part of journalists. Whereas journalists actually live in Israel, they associate with Israelis, they understand what's going on in Israel, very few journalists actually live in the West Bank or in the Gaza Strip. And in fact, in the West Bank, there's only one foreign journalist who lives in the West Bank, and she happens to be an Israeli. Her name is Amira Haas. Apart from that, the journalists don't actually live in the area, and so when they don't live in the area, it becomes very easy for them to just dismiss the killings, dismiss the reports of injuries, and dismiss everything that's happening because they actually don't have any connection to the Palestinians who are living in these areas. So there's a number of reasons. I won't get into the editorial issue, but those are just some of the basic reasons why things have not been covered in the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
Ms. Buttu, this is Will Seaman. I want to remind our listeners that we are taking calls, so if you have a question for our guest today, you can dial 503-231-8187. Ms. Buttu, I was wondering if you could comment on reports that have been coming out of Gaza. UN representatives, human rights representatives, B'Tselem just published a report describing the attack on the power station in Gaza as a war crime, having looked into this, investigated the character of the attack and the justification that was provided by the Israeli military. But I wonder if you could talk about the quite astonishing increase in casualties in Gaza, the deaths among people living in Gaza, many of them children, certainly many of them civilians. Could you talk about how there seems to have been this change in the degree of violence that is that the people there are experiencing?
Yes, definitely. The Israeli attack on the Palestinian transformer, which is the only power station in the Gaza city, they actually have the transformer, not the not just the power station itself, which actually turns out the electricity. Now, the attack on that has ended up impacting almost the entire Gaza Strip with rampant power shortages now taking place. On average, I'm told now, I haven't been down to the Gaza Strip in a while because I cannot get in, but I'm told that there's been power shortages that are rampant, with power only being supplied to Palestinians between 4 to 6 hours on a daily basis. Now, what this means when there's no power being supplied is that it also affects everything from whether you can keep food in the fridge. And this has been a summer that has been particularly hot, so people haven't been able to keep any food in their fridge and anything in their freezer because it all goes bad, to other basic things like being able to pump water. Because the Gaza Strip is such a densely populated place, the vast majority of Palestinians live in high-rise houses, and high-rise houses need electricity to pump the water so that people actually get water provided to their apartments. With the rampant water shortages, water has been in very short supply, and a lot of the water that is coming in is quite brackish. So on top of suffering the lack of electricity, which we've all grown very accustomed to, it's become pretty much a right rather than a luxury, they're also suffering from not having very clean water, from having brackish water. So that's some of the other things that are happening. It also impacts everything from the ability of people while they're in the hospital, to get proper medical treatment. A lot of the machinery requires, obviously, electricity, to other things, such as being able having to fund generators, which is obviously a very costly venture, particularly given that 165,000 employees of the Palestinian Authority haven't been receiving their salaries for almost 7 months now. So life in Gaza has become incredibly difficult. But I think one of the most interesting things is that normally when you have a situation of war, whether the war is taking place in Serbia, Bosnia, in almost any other context, there's usually a war that takes place on one level, but civilian life actually continues on another level. But in the case of the Palestinians, and in particular the Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip, you have a war that's actually taking place against the civilian population, so that civilian life is not actually proceeding as normal. It's become an abnormal existence. So this is unlike the case of other situations of war, where one would go and yes, there would be war and fighting and so on and so forth, but you would see continuation of civilian life. This is not necessarily the case when it comes to Palestinians living in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, because the attacks have taken place against civilians themselves, which is why I believe the UN has been decrying many of these actions and has come out very strongly against Israel's destruction of the power transformer in the Gaza Strip.
Diana, this collective punishment against the Palestinians is against international law and against humanitarian law. What do you think the Israeli government hopes to achieve by collapsing the infrastructure in Gaza, by making the sewage system so unhealthy that disease could break out, by starving the population, etc.? What do you think the Israeli government hopes to accomplish?
You know, that's a really good question, and it's a very difficult question also to answer, because in many cases, I'm not so sure that the Israeli government knows why it's doing it itself, other than to say that it can. Sometimes I think in a lot of ways that it's designed to actually break the will of the Palestinian people, to try to get the Palestinians to turn against one another, so that they will look at Israel as being their savior and you know, look towards other factions as being the cause of their demise. But I think in some cases it's simply a question of Israel can do it. Nobody's Israel from doing it, and because nobody's stopping Israel from doing it, they continue to do it. So that's a lot of the actions that have taken place inside Israel. So in many cases, I think that they're trying to do it as a means. They don't view it as collective punishment. They view it as individualized punishment, and it's mostly for them a means of trying to get extremist actions to stop, and I think that they hope that this will turn the population against itself. But a lot of times I think it is that they just haven't been given the slap on the wrist that they should be given by the international community. And so when Israel goes so far as demolishing people's homes while people are actually in the house, to assassinating Palestinians, including we see now there's been 200 Palestinians who've been assassinated or been killed as a result of an assassination, that when there's no condemnation on the part of the international community, and we've certainly seen the lack of condemnation, that Israel just continues to proceed as though this is something normal.
What can Americans do to convince the U.S. administration to stop funding the terror in Gaza by the Israelis?
I think there's a few things that can be done, and that I think there's a few things that should be done. One of the interesting provisions in U.S. law states that the United States cannot provide armory or artillery to an army if that artillery is going to be used against a civilian population. And you know, there's supposed to be an accounting of when that artillery is used against a civilian population. Now in the case of Israel, they've used everything from F-16s to some of the actual physical weaponry to the tanks against the civilian population, and yet there has been absolutely no accounting against the Israeli government for this. So I think there's something as simple as trying to even get your representatives of Congress to start raising these questions in Congress. Why is it that Israel is considered to be a nation above all nations when it comes to U.S. military assistance in the form of actual weaponry? Beyond the issue of weaponry, there's other means that I think that can be done, which is by simply showing that right now what Israel is not serving as an ally to the United States, and in fact, it's the U.S.'s relationship with Israel that has been the cause of much of the friction and much of the tension in the Middle East. And you hear this from, whether it's from mild governments all the way up down to the street level to other organizations who are basically saying, we don't hate America, we don't hate Americans, but we certainly loathe American foreign policy and American double standards when it comes to this issue. And I think that simply trying to highlight this issue to representatives of Congress and to the government is something that can and should be done. And I hope that it would certainly have some effect.
And our guest today is Diana Bhutu, who is previously a spokesperson for the Palestine Liberation Organization and very active in the struggle for self-determination and human rights in the West Bank and Gaza. Our call-in number here is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. If you have a question for our guest, we only have about four more minutes here with Diana. I wonder, Diana, if you could talk a little bit, perhaps more concretely, of the experience of people on the ground in Gaza. You've mentioned the impact sort of in the abstract in terms of the difficulty of pumping water in high-rise apartments or the difficulty of refrigerating foods, and we should also mention medicines as well with the destruction of the transformer in Gaza. But what is life like? Can you give us some examples of specific people, their experience in Gaza today?
There's many, many, many examples, and I wish we had more than 4 minutes because there are enough examples to fill a lifetime of stories. I'll try to share very briefly two stories of my friends. One of my friends is of all things, an ice cream producer, and he's a man who was actually trained, educated in the United States, and moved back to the Gaza Strip because he really wanted to do something in the Gaza Strip, help the people of the Gaza Strip, is where he's from, and opened up and very successfully managed an ice cream company that that was based in the Gaza Strip, but that also shipped out ice cream to Israel and to the West Bank, as well as maintaining production within the Gaza Strip alone. The his purpose in setting up the operation inside the Gaza Strip was because he really wanted to employ people in the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip has an unemployment rate of roughly 60%, which is an incredibly high rate. So his thinking was he would open up this factory in the Gaza Strip. Unfortunately, given the fact that there's no power, given the fact that people cannot cannot maintain any food, the last thing that they're thinking of keeping in their refrigerators is something like ice cream. And so here is a young entrepreneur, somebody that I'm sure everybody knows or has contact to, somebody like him, who has as a result gone bankrupt as a result of what life is like now in Gaza. There's other stories of people, including a family that I met, a man who hasn't received a salary now because he's a Palestinian Authority employee for almost 7 months, who put an ad into a newspaper to try to sell one of his kidneys so that he would be able to get money in order to feed his children. He lives in a very, very modest home. His children, at the time that I saw them, were dining off of sour cream and a small loaf of bread.
Deanna,
unfortunately, this is what life is like now for many of the Palestinian Authority employees who have no economic means.
Deanna, that is terribly sad. We understand the people in Gaza have reached the level of starving. Thank you for joining us from Ramallah and sharing the grave humanitarian crisis from where you are today.
Thank you very much, Helen. Thank you, Will.
Thank you.
And thank you, Diana, and thank you, Hala. We hope to check back in. We hope that you, Diana, will check back in with us in the coming months. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia Gorge. Now, if you'd like to hear and see more of our guest, Diana Buttu, on these topics, you can check the website www.pdxjustice.org. That's pdxjustice.org, where you can find streaming video of her lecture from last April, the lecture titled From Occupation to Enclosure, Fragmenting the Palestinian State. This was Ms. Buttu's presentation at the Rachel Corrie Peaceworks Conference up in Olympia last April. And you can also check out our recent interviews with Noam Chomsky, Ali Abu Nima, and others. We're going to take a very, very brief musical break, and then we're going to be back speaking with Israeli historian Ilan Pape, author of The Making of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, 1948 to 1951, and more recently, A History of Modern Palestine, One Land, Two Peoples. And we're back. I'm William Seaman with Hala Goris, and on the phone with us from his home in Haifa, northern Israel, is Israeli historian Ilan Pape. He is author of The Making of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, 1948 to 1951, more recently A History of Modern Palestine, One Land, Two Peoples, and The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. Earlier this month, he published an essay, Genocide in Gaza, at the website Electronic Intifada. Ilan, thank you for joining us this morning.
It's a pleasure to be with you, and I hope I can hear a bit better as the interview continues.
Okay, we'll try to speak up.
Oh, that's better. Okay.
Hopefully we'll have some calls as well, and I hope very much that you'll be able to hear some call-ins today. Now, let's start with this essay from earlier this month. Ilan, the word genocide is certainly a politically loaded term, evoking the mass killings in Darfur, Rwanda, Cambodia, and, of course, for a Jewish audience, the Holocaust. It's clear from this essay you did not choose that word casually. What are your perceptions of the latest crisis in Gaza that led you to describing Israeli policies there as constituting genocide?
Yes, indeed. I was very hesitant before using the term for all the reasons that you've mentioned. But it's very difficult to describe Israeli policies all in all, not just when it comes to massive killings, also when it comes lately to uprooting and transferring people, because they are maintained for such a long period of time that actually it's their accumulative outcome that we refer to, rather than to what they've been doing for 1 week or 2 weeks, which is usually the historical cases you refer to, or even for 4 years. So I think this was first an overview of 6 years and trends which show escalation in the Israeli policies towards the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The second reason why I chose this term was because I realized that the Israelis are lost. They have no idea what to do with the Gaza Strip. Whereas they think, and that may also be a mistake, but at least they think that because the West Bank has a border with Jordan, some sort of a solution would be found by which they can push out Palestinians towards areas which would be adjacent to Jordan and somehow get rid of these people that, from their point of view, are a problem. But they have no such ideas of how to deal with the Gaza Strip. They took out the settlers. They imprisoned the Gaza people within a huge prison camp. Lately, the United Nations admitted that this is the case in Gaza. And yet the inmates, if you want, in the prison continue to resist the impossible conditions imposed on them. And the Israelis are thinking, what can they do next? And in the meantime, they bombard the most dense area in the world with F-16s, shell them with cannons, with cannons from the sea as well, with the Navy ships. The daily reap is several people, quite often children, killed inside the Gaza Strip. And from what everyone hears from the Israeli policymakers, this is going to continue and escalate.
I want to mention to our callers again that if they'd like to ask our guest any questions, please give us a call at 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. We'd love to hear from you. Ilan Pape is our guest, Israeli historian. Ilan, now during the recent Lebanon war, I thought this was interesting that you mentioned this in your essay. There were reports of Israeli pilots refusing to execute attacks on targets that they believed were attacks that they believed were likely to kill civilians. And in your article, you mentioned something called the Lebanon procedure. Could you explain that and tell us whether you think this is common practice and whether it reflects Israeli policy?
Yes, indeed. I mentioned that in the first Lebanon war in 1982, there was something which would later was called the Lebanon procedure. The Israeli pilots in 1982 were instructed to abort a mission if they found out that the targets that they were sent to bomb were not the ones that they thought they were. Namely, if a military target was proved to be a civilian target, they were to abort mission and return back. And they also defined a parameter of a radius of 500 meters as an area in which if civilians are within this radius, even if there are military targets in it, the mission should be aborted. Now, in the second Lebanon war, the pilots asked whether this procedure is still intact, and they were told not anymore. But this was not the first time that they inquired whether the procedure was intact. A few weeks before the second Lebanon war started, the Israeli pilots started bombarding systematically the Gaza Strip, and they asked a similar question, and the answer was again in the negative, that in the densely, one of the probably the most dense area in the world, there is no point in appropriating this procedure, namely bomb massively regardless of how many civilians there are and how many civilian casualties would be the outcome of such attacks.
Professor Pape, good morning. This is Hala Goris.
Good morning.
I have a question for you about Israeli society in general in terms of what is happening in Gaza. Is it widely known that Gazans are being suffocated, starved, and bombed?
Well, let me put it this way. Most Israelis do not want to know. It's very easy to know. Most of them do not want to know. The Israeli media, almost all of it, mainstream and what supposedly is more critical, collaborate in this denial. There are hardly any reports, and the reports which there are being sidelined to a very marginal place in the newspaper or the news bulletin on the radio or in television. But on the other hand, given the internet revolution that we have, of course, every Israeli can know exactly what happens, but they choose not to know. So I think that's the situation, which I think the term denial is an apt term for describing such an attitude towards the reality around us.
You know, for those in denial, they must know there is something to be in denial about. So I'm trying to understand how it is that those in Israel are not absolutely up in arms about what the Air Force is doing, what the military is doing in Gaza, as well as the West Bank.
Well, in order to understand it, one has to go back to the what I call the ideological infrastructure of the state, which is transmitted to people, to the citizens, through the educational system, the cultural media, the media itself. Yeah? And there you can see very easily. Hello?
Are you still there? We can still hear
yes,
you.
Yes, I'm still there. Are you there?
Yes, we're here. Can you hear us?
Yeah, we're there. Okay, I'll continue.
Thank you.
Through the educational system, the main message that an citizen of Israel receives is that is a dehumanization of the Palestinians, to make it short. A dehumanization. In other words, I'm not sure that even if people would know the extent and the scope of the killing and the bombardment from the air, people would feel any remorse or any problem with that. We saw it in the Lebanon War. Some of the worst, some of the main criticism directed against the Israeli army was that it did not flatten the Palestinian villager, that it was not killing enough Palestinians. This was the main criticism, not the actual killing, Lebanese citizens, not the actual bombardment of Lebanese villages, but the very what they thought was a limited scope of bombardment.
What in terms of opposing views? That is, we can talk broadly about the peace movement, but there are certainly that in itself is a fairly vague sort of politics in Israel. But surely there's some part of the population, as there is in the United States, in terms of resistance to the U.S. war and occupation in Iraq and Afghanistan, that are active in opposing these kinds of policies.
Well, I think it's a negligent opposition movement. I think it's important that it exists. I think it allows people like myself to have a framework for acting against the occupation. But if one wants to remain realistic and assess the chances of such an opposition from within, one should boldly and courageously say that they have very little chance in changing opinions or in changing, the policies themselves. I think the importance of these opposing groups is for building a better future in the long term, but they are very negligent as far as changing the current Israeli policies or the Israeli policies in the near future. For that, you need a very strong pressure from the outside. For that, you need to adopt the South African model. You need to turn the state into a pariah state as long as these policies continue. That's the only way of stopping the killings in Gaza.
Yeah, and that's certainly a nice segue into the conclusion of your essay, where you essentially call for international pressure on Israel. I was when I was in Gaza a few years ago, I was very fortunate to interview Dr. Haider Abdel Shafi, and he pointed out that an earlier occupation of Gaza, in the case of a much earlier occupation, the U.S. snapped its fingers and Israel withdrew within 24 hours. What's your perception of the U.S. role in all of this? We can talk about the international community, but the main paymaster is the United States. And that's through Democratic and Republican administrations alike. Do you see, in terms of that support, has that also influenced the political landscape in Israel today?
Yes, I'll put it crudely. Without the United Nations, without the United States support, these policies would have been impossible. Without the United States support, Israel would have not been able to do what it did in Lebanon. And without that support, Israel could not have continued an occupation, which is a very costly business. So the youth role is crucial and in fact conditional for the success of these policies. So I think it's there shouldn't be any doubt of it. And as pointed by Haider Abdel-Shafi, the U.S. has the potential of playing a very different role in bringing about a change in these policies. But ever since 9/11, and probably before 9/11, various movements in the United States, like the Christian Zionists, the neoconservatives, and the pro-Zionist lobby, AIPAC, were pushing, one should say successfully, towards the policies that gives Israel a blank check for pursuing these policies. Israel can do these policies knowing that it has the American umbrella, not only in terms of getting military aid and financial support, but also being immune from any international criticism and pressure.
Professor Pape, in terms of international pressure, are you talking about boycotting and divestment?
Yes, I think a variety of means should be examined. I don't think we have found yet the way to do it. This is certainly a much more complex case study than the case study of South Africa. But I would say that even the beginnings I have seen of what I call moral sanctions, namely that these were not actual sanctions, but they were a threat to sanction Israel, have really had an impact here. People here want very much to be considered to be part of the Western world, what they call the civilized world. And if this world sends a message that there is a price tag attached to these policies, even in terms of considering any Israeli request to be part of an international organization, for receiving international aid, for concluding bilateral agreements and so on every level, not just the state level, but on academic level or any other institutional level. I think these kinds of actions send a very powerful message to the Israelis that very important people in the world, in their eyes, do not condone what they do and in fact condemn it and are willing to pressure them to change it. This hasn't happened as yet. So we are trying to organize it because I really think this is the only way of salvaging not only the Palestinians from future destruction, but also the Israelis themselves from what will happen once they have implemented their policies against the Palestinians, the full.
Can you tell us how you are trying to organize this boycott or divestment program?
Well, I cannot organize it myself. I mean, I'm here. I can only give moral support to those who organize. So I think it's very interesting. I think it started by the civil society in the occupied territories, calling a few years ago for the outside world to help them to end the 40 years occupation and future plans of destroying them. And the call was very powerful, very well articulated, and many, many parts of the Palestinian civil society under occupation took part in this call. This was taken by all kinds of groups around the world who support that call. And in a certain stage, these people approached people like myself saying that it is important to have also a moral voice from within the Jewish state, saying that we accept this as the only way forward because the Palestinian armed struggle is self-destructive, didn't lead to anywhere, and the peace process has failed. And at that stage, I, and not only myself, few others, we joined in and we said that morally we accept it, and realistically, by analyzing it, we see it as the only way forward, although I must tell you I'm not that optimistic. I'm not sure that even this would be enough to change the dismal situation on the ground.
And I want to mention once again to our listeners that if you have a question for our guest, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187 is the call-in number here at KABU. Our guest is Ilan Pape, Israeli historian. He is author of The Making of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, 1948 to 1951, and more recently, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this more recent book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. I must say that, like using the word genocide in terms of describing what is happening in Gaza, the use of this phrase, ethnic cleansing, as well, is going to raise some hackles for people in terms of their perceptions.
First of all, I'm not the first one to use it. In fact, some historians used it before me, some Palestinian historians, and even an Israeli historian who supports the actions of 1948 called it an ethnic cleansing. This is my colleague Benny Morris. Both of us were once termed as the new historians of Israel. So I think this is a much more acceptable term to academics, at least, who look at the policy of uprooting people in 1948. What I do in the book, I try and show that this is a paradigm, a paradigm of thought that fed the Israeli actions in 1948, but also feeds the Israeli actions ever since 1948. I think the basic idea is that Jewish welfare and well-being in Palestine cannot be secured as long as there are Palestinians on the ground. And the big debate inside Israel is, of course, of how to achieve it. But nobody argues against the logic of this assumption. And I'm trying to show how in 1948 and after 1948, this paradigm, this ideological framework, conceived from that ideological framework, the policies of 1948 and after 1948 were conceived and formulated. So this was the fountain, if you want, the ideological fountain that from which most Israeli policymakers drink, and which it can explain many of the Israeli actions, including the one we talked about before, the Israeli policy, the current Israeli policies towards the Gaza Strip.
And we actually have a caller with a question on this topic. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. My question is whether Zionism is strictly a political movement or whether it is also a religious movement, and whether there is confusion about what Zionism actually is and what the implications might be. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for your question. It's a good one. do I have an hour?
10 minutes.
That's what I make. I know. I'll try and make it short. I think that, first of all, it's a political movement. It's an ideological movement. However, it's an ideological movement that tried to politicize a religion. In fact, this is the best way of putting it. It took a very wealthy and rich religious heritage of Judaism that moved people outside of Zionism to amazing acts of bravery and moral courage against discrimination, oppression, wherever they found it, and turned that very rich legacy into a very narrow one, which created the basis for how to secure the group of people who settled in Palestine in 1882 and thereafter. So I think religion is being exploited here in order to justify the actual colonization of Palestine in 1882, and then to justify the policies against the native population of Palestine, the Palestinians, and I think we're still in a project in the making, which has not as yet ended.
Professor Pape, we have one more caller. Caller, you're on.
Professor, how does one contend with the powerful Jewish lobby here in the United States? It's so difficult. Anyone that opposes the policies of Israel is immediately called anti-Semitic, and they're ostracized. They don't get on the air. They don't get on the radio. How would you suggest we confront this lobby that has taken hold of American policy?
Thank you for your question. First of all, I think you're right. It's a very powerful disincentive for people to come forward, even if they think that the Israeli policies are wrong and if they think that the American support for these policies are wrong. So I think it's a very good question. I would also point out that it's not only the lobby. I mean, there is also the problem of the Christian Zionists, which is a powerful movement outside the lobby, which also influences American policy. But as far as the lobby is concerned, I think that one of the best ways of confronting it is to warn that since American policy is going from wrong to from bad to worse, and the Iraqi quagmire is a very good example, the fact that the lobby has associated so much these policies with the safety of Israel by itself can create a resurgence of anti-Semitism, because people would say America has failed dramatically. And why had it failed? Because it was trying to satisfy the interests of a proxy and not the American national security. Secondly, I think there are alternative voices in the Jewish community in the United States. They have to be organized. They have to speak in the name of Judaism against this abuse of the Holocaust memory, against this abuse of Jewish values. It shouldn't be left just to people who are Palestinians or are supporters of the Palestinian cause. And I think Israelis like myself can add their voice. I can tell you from my own experience in tours in the United States that the AIPAC people disappear into thin air when I speak, because they have very little to say to me, and I can hardly be accused of anti-Semitism. And the last point I will make, I think they've overdone the anti-Semitic card. It's going to wane. It's going to peter out. I don't think it works anymore, and I think people should not be deterred by it and shouldn't be afraid by it, and then we can face it, confront it, and push for a much better and more productive American policy.
Professor, thank you for talking to us about what the Jewish community can do on this issue. For our listeners, if you go to www.jewishvoiceforpeace.org, great organization and terrific resource. Also, Chicago's chapter of the Jewish Voice for Peace has a great website. It's www.notinmyname, but actually it's www.nimn.org.
And there's certainly locally Jewish organizations that are weighing in on these issues. And across the country, more and more of these organizations. But, of course, not just Jewish organizations. There's also the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, which you can find at endtheoccupation.org. In terms of your perceptions of organizing around these issues, I mean, in the last 5 years, we've had the emergence of the International Solidarity Organization, people on the ground in the occupied territories doing this work in solidarity with Palestinians. We've seen the emergence of these anti-occupation organizations here in the United States. What's your perception from within Israel in terms of an increase in activism? Do you think it's significant what's happening? I know I also wanted to mention there was this question about the divestment campaign, and there is the Caterpillar campaign in particular. This is a campaign targeting the Caterpillar Corporation, which provides these giant, I think they're called D9 armored bulldozers that are used not just to destroy housing, but they're essentially used as a weapon in the occupation.
Yes, indeed. I think that judging from the way that the campaign developed in the case of South Africa, where there were also ups and downs, and it took longer than people remember to get the campaign going, we are unfortunately only in the beginning of the campaign. I say unfortunately because I'm not sure we have the same amount of time that the people in South Africa had. It took about 21 years in South Africa to establish a meaningful and an effective anti-apartheid movement that worked in solidarity with the ANC. We don't even have a proper ANC. That's another problem. But I think that definitely with each passing month and year, another center of activity emerges in the United States or in Europe or elsewhere that shows that people just had enough. They watch on TV or they visit themselves, as you mentioned, the ISM, and see for themselves what's going on, and they feel that they want to help the people on the ground to stop it. The thing is, we still need a coordinating hand. We still need a much more expanded activity, but it is growing. In fact, it's inevitable. It's inevitable after 40 years of occupation for a place which is so much at the center of attention that this would happen. The big question is which pace is going to win? The slow, now for the time being, the slow pace of creating such a powerful civil society movement to change things on the ground, or the very presently quick pace of destruction of the Israeli will to change the realities on the ground, because they feel that they have a window of opportunity with the unequivocal American support to create irreversible facts that would make any future attempts to change it impossible.
And on that note, we're going to have to bring an end to this segment with our guest, Israeli historian Ilan Pappe. Ilan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we have a number of announcements we'd like to talk about. As Ilan Pappe pointed out, there's this question of what is going to happen, how are things going to unfold there, and we face a choice very much up to us, and I'd like to talk about some, Hala's going to talk about some events here locally you can get involved with.
Portland's a great place to be this afternoon at Pioneer Square, Southwest Broadway and Yamhill, between 3 to 7 p.m. is the Indian Day Celebration, in celebration of American Indian culture and our Northwest tribes. There will be drumming groups, dancers, art vendors. Show them your support and go down to Pioneer Square.
I want to mention the music that you're going to hear in a moment. The music that introduced this program is by Rahim Al-Haj. He's a wonderful musician. He plays the oud, and he's going to be in Portland on Saturday, October 28th, 7 p.m. at the First Congregational Church. That's a part of a weekend of events. Jamming for Peace is the musical program, but it's part of a weekend of events focused on the situation in Iran and the possibility of the United States attacking Iran. And that is, again, Saturday, October 28th.
And one last announcement, October 4th from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at PSU, Mercy Corps will be speaking about the update from Lebanon and Gaza, the humanitarian crises.
And you have been listening to a special KABU Public Affairs program, Focus on the Crisis in Gaza. I'm William Seaman, and with me today, Hala Gores. Thank you very much for listening, and continue your support of KABU Community Grassroots Democratic Media. Thank you.